This is a session on economic justice for all, biblical vision, and ethical norms. It's the first in a series on the U.S. Catholic Bishop's recent pastoral letter on Catholic social teaching and the United States economy. My name is John Shelley, and I teach in the religion department at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. Over the last 3 years, have developed a team talk course at Furman in economic justice that I team teach with an economist. And I dearly wish that my co-teacher could be here because I certainly do not claim to be an expert in matters relating to economics or even to matters relating to ethics. This afternoon, I was in Mark Edwards' session on Luther, and in that session, you had a Lutheran teaching Lutherans about Luther. In this session, we have a Baptist leading a session on the Roman Catholic Bishop's letter to a group that is predominantly Lutheran. So I guess this will be an ecumenical venture of sorts. How many of you have heard of the Roman Catholic Bishop's letter on the U.S. economy? Okay. How many of you have read the letter? Okay, one, two. Numbers are dwindling. How many have read about the letter? Okay. Were these, like articles in the newspaper or something? Okay, Time had a article on it, and for a period of about 6 weeks, just about every major syndicated columnist of a political sort had at least one column on the bishop's letter. What perceptions do you bring to the bishop's letter if you've heard about it and read a little about it? What perceptions do you bring?
Our system isn't good for everybody.
Okay, that the bishops are saying that that's a good way to put it, that our system isn't good for everybody, the economic system. Any other perceptions?
It seems to be lifting up the situation of the poor in a couple of ways. Their situation of poverty, but their lack of power to participate within the economy that benefits other sectors.
Okay, one of the basic themes is what the bishops refer to as the preferential option for the poor, which is related to their understanding of justice as participation. Now we'll come to that tonight. I might take this opportunity to do a little plug for the bookstore. The bishop's letter, which came out in its final form last November of 86, has been published as a little paperback, Economic Justice for All, and I think the bookstore has about 5 or 6 copies of this. I'm not sure exactly what the price is. Probably around $3. But if you're interested, you can pick up a copy there at the bookstore. You'll also find in the bookstore a summary of the major themes of the bishop's letter. I think it runs about 75 cents, and it's just a little pamphlet that will summarize the basic themes of the whole letter if you don't want to read the whole thing. When the bishops talk about a letter, they're not talking about a 1 or 2 page thing. These pastorals, this is 187 pages, for example. Now, it's not particularly small print or big pages, but a second book that you will find in the bookstore is one by J. Philip Wagerman, professor of social ethics at the Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, Economics and Ethics. This is a 1986 publication that parallels a number of themes that the bishops develop. And Wagerman treats these, I think, in a in a very thorough, and for me at least, a very convincing way. There's also a book in there, Good News for the Poor by Walter Pilgrim, that basically focuses on Luke and Acts, but it does a lot of biblical exegesis of other parts of the Bible as well, about the understanding of the poor and the nature of poverty in the Bible. Well, let's start with a little introduction to the bishop's letter. In 1982, the Roman Catholic bishops came out with a a pastoral letter called The Challenge for Peace, which was a letter. And in the Roman Catholic tradition, the idea of a pastoral letter is a very venerable and very old way of speaking to one's congregations. The letter on the challenge of peace dealt primarily with the morality of nuclear war. And the bishops got into, created quite a bit of controversy with that letter. But at least a year before that letter came out in its final form, they had already begun the process of this letter on economics. It was in 1981 that they appointed an ad hoc committee of five bishops, and the chairman was Archbishop Weakland of Milwaukee. And over a period of about 18 months, they held a number of hearings, I think about 18 or 20 hearings, in which they invited economists and theologians and ethicists and social workers from a variety of ideologies and backgrounds to come and appear before their committee. In November of 1984, they presented a first draft to the meeting of the National Conference of Bishops in Washington. And that created quite a stir nationally. It made front page news in the New York Times, and the New York Times excerpted about a page and a half, newspaper pages, of salient passages from the letter. And the idea was that they would complete a second draft in about 6 months, and then a final draft to be voted on at the meeting in November 1985. But the first draft stirred so much debate that they postponed the final draft until November 1986, and in the meantime did two additional drafts, and so this is actually a fourth draft of the letter, the final letter. Now, the letter begins with a kind of preface in which the bishops make a little statement about why they're doing this. And then they move through several chapters. They have a kind of introductory chapter, The Church and the Future of the U.S. Economy. Chapter 2 is The Christian Vision of Economic Life. And here you have a biblical section, and then from that biblical section they derive certain ethical norms by which they want to judge any economy, but particularly the economy of the United States. And once they have these norms in place, then they claim that there are some places where our economy needs some real work in making it fair for all. Then they select out, in chapter 3, four policy issues. And try to, bishops are often accused of being abstract, and so they sort of take the challenge here of trying to say how these norms might be expressed in specific policies. What do you think those four policy areas might be? Now, those of you that have read the letter, if you were selecting out four policy issues, you think? Well, the first one they deal with is unemployment, and it deals with the whole issue of work and what work means. And one of the controversial claims they make is that people have a right to a job, just like we have a right to worship as we please and to assemble when we want to and to vote and things like this. They claim that this should be added to our list of rights. Now, we'll talk in a minute about how they arrive at these. And the issue of work is the one that I want us to talk about specifically on Wednesday night. I've entitled that Modern Work and Human Meaning. Does one have a right to a job? The second issue they pick is poverty. They deal with unemployment first because they claim that employment is really the first line of defense against poverty. And so then they go with poverty, which ties in, of course, to the notion of the preferential option for the poor. And then the last two, third policy issue, has to do with farming and agriculture. This did not appear in the first draft, although they left a space for it. Apparently they had some trouble writing that, but it is a part of the final letter. And then the final section deals with policies that relate the United States to the world economy, particularly to the economy of developing nations. And that's the issue that my brother and I will lead a discussion on Friday evening. Tomorrow night I want to do the preferential option for the poor and what the bishops have to say about poverty and what their critics have to say. Any questions so far? Peter?
I don't know what the preferential option for the poor is. So.
Okay, just hold on to that. Let me talk about what the bishop means by justice as participation. The bishop's letter on economic justice stands firmly in a Roman Catholic tradition that goes back at least to 1891. One has references to economic issues, such things as what's a just price and what's a just wage, going back to the Church Fathers and to Thomas Aquinas, whether it was permissible to collect interest on one's money. But sort of social ethics as a discipline of the church is usually dated from 1891, when Pope Leo XIII wrote an encyclical called Rerum Novarum. Now, papal encyclicals are named by the first words in Latin, and so even if you know Latin, though, it doesn't always tell you much what the encyclicals are about. But the sort of the theme of that encyclical is the condition of the working man. And partly as a result of pressure from United States bishops, the Pope Leo XIII came out in favor of labor unions. So you have a strong Catholic emphasis here on labor unions. And this marks the beginning of the church addressing officially and systematically the social, political, and economic dimensions of human existence. And this current letter, if you are one who reads footnotes, it has copious references to these earlier papal encyclicals, beginning with the one by Leo XIII. One thing that's new in this letter, however, is the prominence of Scripture in establishing the vision of social justice. One of the things that Vatican II did, now Vatican II, this was the Second Vatican Council called by Pope John the 23rd in the early 60s. And it marked some significant changes in the Roman Catholic Church. I was in the first generation of students to go to seminary after Vatican II. And we had Catholic students, even in the Baptist Seminary in Louisville and at Vanderbilt, there were nuns and priests and that came to study both on divinity degrees and doing graduate work. And one of the things that Vatican II did was sort of cut loose a lot of the restrictions that had hampered Roman Catholic biblical scholars. And so now in 1987, hardly anybody anymore, at least at the academic level, you know, pays that much attention whether this book on the parables is by a Roman Catholic or a Lutheran or a Methodist or whatever, because there's a sense of sharing here that cuts across all of these denominational differences. And Roman Catholics have made a tremendous contribution in the fields of Old and New Testament. And one of the men who has been very influential in this particular part, John Donahue, a Jesuit New Testament scholar that was one of my teachers at one time, was one of the leaders in putting together this section on the kind of a biblical vision of economic life. Now, the bishops want to talk about justice as full participation in the social and economic system. And this idea of justice as full participation is grounded in three central ideas that they derive from this biblical exposition. One, they talk about the dignity of each individual. The kind of biblical themes they deal with. Now, we can go into this. Last Saturday night, Jack Nelson Palmer led a very fine discussion here on biblical justice and lifestyle. And he stole about 10 minutes of my presentation going through these scripture references of the sabbatical year and the jubilee year. Are these familiar terms to most of you? The sabbatical year, provision, the jubilee year? I see some. Okay. Well, maybe it won't be an overkill to talk about this. The bishops, this idea of the preferential option for the poor and the dignity of each individual and the solidarity of all human beings, they reach back, begin in the Old Testament. For example, in the Covenant Code, the Ten Commandments, of course, are found in Exodus 20. But in the Covenant Code, which is roughly the three chapters following the Ten Commandments, what you have there are attempts to draw out the meaning of the Ten Commandments and apply it to everyday kinds of issues. For example, the commandment, "You shall not kill." What does that mean specifically? And there's an interesting little thing in the Covenant Code about a guy who has an ox, and the ox gores somebody. Now, should the owner of the ox be held accountable for killing? And it's interesting that if the ox has never gored anybody before, then if he gores somebody, then you simply stone the ox, but the owner goes free. But if the ox has gored somebody previously, and the owner's been warned, and it happens again, and somebody dies as a result of it, then you stone both of them. Well, the Covenant Code is something like that. But for our purposes, in the Covenant Code, and in all of the legal traditions in the Old Testament, whether they're in Leviticus or Deuteronomy. There's a kind of special concern for the stranger, the widow, the orphan. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. This little phrase, you were strangers, or you were slaves, repeatedly appears in connection with this kind of special concern for the stranger or the widow or orphan. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fathers. So you have this theme of this kind of special attention to the widow and the orphan, the helpless. And these are the ones who are vulnerable. And I think it's in Deuteronomy 24, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore I command you to do this. When you reap your harvest in your field, and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand. In other words, you were to leave behind, you know, grain for the widow and the orphan, for the poor. The sabbatical year was a provision that every seventh year the land was to lie fallow. And part of the purpose of that was it was good agriculture. The land needed to regain the nutrients so it could produce crops again. Coming from South Carolina, we have a lot of farmland that was completely ruined by the cotton industry. Cotton was planted just year after year after year, and now it will produce virtually nothing. So this is good agricultural practice, but there's also a moral intent here. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the wild beasts may eat. I guess sort of the idea was that, you know, if you let it lie fallow, there's going to be some grain that's going to grow up just naturally on it from seeds that had dropped the year before, and that's to be left for the poor. So if you put together the legal tradition, and the other night Jack dealt so well with the prophetic tradition, people like Amos and Jeremiah, I mean, to know God is to be specifically concerned for the poor, then the whole Old Testament thrust is that a society is to be judged primarily in terms of how it treats its weak and helpless, you know, the people who are vulnerable and without power. They continue this into the New Testament, talking about the kingdom of God, and they also cite Luke 4, the passage there where Jesus comes to proclaim good news to the poor, and talk about the call of discipleship, which has to do some very specific things to say about how the disciple of Jesus ought to use his or her wealth. Well, kind of based upon these scriptural references, and then what they call biblical themes of creation, covenant, and community, they derive these three basic ideas: the dignity of each individual, the solidarity of all human beings, And three, the preferential option for the poor and the marginalized. And so what they want to say is that an economic system, we ought to ask questions like, how well does this system encourage or recognize or appreciate the essential dignity of every individual human being? Secondly, how well does this system recognize the fact that we are all essentially one family? And how well does it encourage a sense of community that is much deeper than simply a group of people who have a self-interested relationship to each other, you know, kind of built on mutual self-interest? There's a poem by T.S. Eliot, one of the choruses from The Rock, that it goes like this. When the stranger says, "What is the meaning of this city? Are you huddled close together because you love each other?" What will you answer? "We dwell together to make money from each other," or "This is a community." See, simply because people get together and are found in groups doesn't necessarily mean there's a real community there. And so what the bishops are trying to do is to say that that so often in our system, what we call community is simply a kind of gathering of mutual self-interest. We gather because we can make some kind of contract and exchange that we both benefit from. But then that's the extent of the contact. I did a paper about a year ago on kind of changing perceptions of marriage. And this was not an original idea of mine by any means. But there are some subtle changes going on, I think, in the way we think about marriage. And one contemporary ethicist has said that rather than seeing marriage primarily in terms of covenant, that is a kind of unconditional commitment to each other, which is what the traditional vows suggest marriage is, that marriage is coming to be understood as a kind of mutual liability contract. In other words, I enter into marriage primarily in terms of what I can get out of it. And then when the benefits that I get from marriage no longer outweigh the cost to me, then one simply dissolves the marriage as one does contract. So when the bishops talk about the solidarity of all human beings, they're trying to say that there is a dimension to human existence, a social dimension, a communal dimension, that is deeper than simply a relationship of mutual self-interest. And so when we're asked about, when we're trying to judge an economy, we, we need to be concerned about how well these economic structures and policies encourage the formation of community in the biblical sense. And then this preferential option for the poor. The dignity of each individual is based upon the image of God and simply affirms that each person is of infinite worth and therefore an end to be served by the economic order and not a means for the production and accumulation of wealth. In other words, the economic order is made for persons, not vice versa, and there can be only one fundamental criterion for economic decisions, policies, and institutions. They must all be at the service of human beings. Now, the bishops contend that the dignity of the individual can be fully realized and protected only within a community of human beings. Emphasis on community there. The letter thus tacitly rejects the atomistic individualism, the kind of radical emphasis on individuals that undergirds traditional defenses of economic freedom, private property, and laissez-faire capitalism. The Catholic tradition is certainly more communitarian than the Protestant. And so some of the bishop's critics have said, well, that's just that old Catholic communitarianism. And therefore, this is a letter just for Catholics. But I think the emphasis is thoroughly biblical, and is certainly assumed by most contemporary Protestant emphasis. The implication is that economic structures and policies must be judged in terms of whether they enhance or destroy human community. The bishop's proposals are hardly radical, but they clearly assume that current U.S. policies are not contributing sufficiently to the enhancement of human community. The poor and the marginalized are, by definition, those excluded from the larger community. Now, I've injected a new word here. The poor and marginalized, those people that kind of live on the margin. Some of you were here last week. I take a particular delight in where words come from. And my colleague Mark Edwards said, don't put too much stock in those etymologies. And I think he's right. That's a good warning. But the origin of the name Hebrew basically meant the marginal people. This is debated, but it seems to have come from an ancient Semitic word that referred to the landless strangers that kind of existed on the fringes of the settled, civilized world. And later, of course, it came to refer to a specific people. But the idea of the poor and the marginalized sort of fits in with that Old Testament understanding. But the marginals are those who, they're the poor, they're the vulnerable, the powerless, those who don't have a voice. Hence, the bishops insist on a preferential option for the poor, by which they mean, and this will get at Peter's question, what they're talking about here are strategies that are designed to bring the poor back into the community as full participants in both its benefits and responsibilities. In other words, what they are saying is that we need to try to find strategies to bring these people back into the community so that they can participate in the community. It is in this context, therefore, that one must read and evaluate the bishop's specific proposals. The call for a more equitable distribution of income and wealth, for example, is not based upon some abstract ideal of equality, but upon a realistic assessment of the minimal requirements for full participation in the larger community. In fact, the bishops assert that inequality is morally permissible to the extent that it contributes to the common good. In other words, they're saying that it might be, given our situation, morally permissible to allow some people to make more money than others if that contributes to the good of the whole. There may be some positions that entail a certain risk or sacrifice or something. Okay, the question of economic justice then for the bishops takes the form of trying to lay out the minimum conditions for life in community. And for the bishops, this translates into a call for an economic bill of rights that will be given the same respect and protection as our civil and political rights. As an absolute minimum, say the bishops, such a charter should include the right to food, clothing, shelter, rest, and medical care and education. But also, and this is where they're kind of on a, maybe breaking a little bit of new ground, additional guarantees such as gainful employment, a fair wage, and healthful working conditions. The bishops appeal to the consciences of various economic agents. They have a section in there where they address business people, labor unions, consumers, employees, to establish and recognize such guarantees, but they do not believe that private sources alone can adequately implement and protect these rights. Hence the government, which is the only agent that represents the whole national community, must serve as the final guarantor of economic rights. Now this appeal to government puts the bishops at odds with prevailing attitudes in Washington, where the Reagan administration is slowly eroding the government support of social programs. Well, that in a that's a kind of summary of the of, you know, that gives you a kind of overall picture of what the bishops are doing. They want a system that's going to protect the essential dignity of every individual. Their view of human being is such that individuals can fulfill themselves only in some kind of genuine community. And that what we need to do is to develop strategies that will bring the poor and the marginals back into the community as a whole. Well, let me kind of pause here and what do you think the critics have said about the bishops?
Goes against the American way. Destroy the fabric of our economy.
Okay. The bishops have gotten very little support from newspapers and commentators. Because it's hardly a radical statement, really. I mean, it is, people on the left have criticized it for not being radical enough. But the Wall Street Journal and the typical commentators have been doing.
I would guess one comment would be, what are they doing talking about economic affairs? They should stay in their own realm.
Exactly. That this has been James Kilpatrick, for example, made this point. He spent about a half of an article talking about how the bishops are good men and they mean well. But they ought to get back to the business of religion, which is what? The relationship of individual human beings to God. And so he was, being the Southern gentleman that he is, I mean, Kilpatrick said these are nice guys and all, but, you know, they don't understand what the religion's about.
I remember one time hearing an executive from a major farm implement dealer talking in the context to farmers, and it was an event held at Wartburg Seminary. It was kind of on what was happening with the farm crisis and the ethics of that. And this economist basically said at one point in his talk that to wear out the soil was no more important than a house wearing down. It was fine to wear down the soil because eventually enough capital would be drawn there that you could apparently restore it, that great effort. And in response to, I guess it was some of my comments and some comments of some other pastors or professors there that was highly critical of that way to look at the soil, he basically just kind of smirked and laughed and said, you people aren't economists. Yeah. This is an area that you should not deal in. Leave it to us.
Yeah.
I think that's a very, very common attitude. I also find it frightening and very dangerous because I think economics is too important to leave to be kind of alone.
That is an excellent point. The economics department at Furman, this is essentially their point of view, except for the economists that I team teach with. When I first got to Furman in 1980, I went tripping down to the EBA department because I had taught an interdisciplinary course at Franklin, where I had just come from, and had a great time with the team teaching. And the attitude of the economists, and these are very decent people, but their attitude was that, look, economics is a science. And that, you know, you start bringing all these value questions in here, and you don't, you know, what does it mean to bring these value questions in? In this little book by Wagaman, he has an excellent little paragraph or two in here on American pragmatism. This is kind of the essential American philosophy. We are problem solvers. The idea of pragmatism is that you begin with a problem, and then you say, okay, now this is the problem, how are we going to solve it? And pragmatism is sort of built on the assumption that we can leave values out of problem solving, that it becomes a kind of technical solution. And this is where a lot of economists are at. And then Wagaman gives a couple of examples. He says, let's take the problem of unemployment. Now, the thing of it is that there are some people that benefit from high unemployment. And so, in fact, one of the points I want to make Wednesday night is that over the last 20 years, there has been a subtle shift in this country in what is regarded as full employment. That 20 years ago, full employment was regarded as 3% unemployment, and now full employment is between 6 and 7%. In other words, we'll talk about some of the reasons for that tonight. But what Wagaman is saying is that when you get a problem, there's almost always some people that benefit from it. Just like inflation is another example he uses, that many of us see this as a problem. But if we've got a lot of real estate, you know, we might benefit from a certain amount of inflation. Now, nobody wants inflation to the extent that it's going to disrupt the social fabric completely, but or to return to conditions of the Depression with 30% unemployment. So I think you're right that a lot of economists think of economics as a science. There are certain laws, and therefore it is not proper to raise questions of value, to raise ethical questions.
How many people here think it is a science?
Well, I wish we had an economist here.
I think it's a social science.
Yeah. Well, that's an oxymoron.
Well, the science of the numbers is very statistical. Yeah. But anyone who takes, go through the economics courses finds you have a full set of assumptions that have already established what the values are, what the average person will do in a given situation, the prudent thing, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So they have a set of values already established.
Yeah.
But from that point on, then they take the numbers, and it is science.
That's very, very helpful that they do have certain assumptions that they make and that they start with.
If you don't have value questions, how do you recognize a problem or a solution?
Well, if you for example, just as he was talking about, one of the kind of hidden values usually for the economist is something like efficiency or growth, economic growth, or what?
Perfect knowledge. Often it's so that you know where
markets will be, profit maximization.
So, I mean, there's a tendency, if you think of something as a science, particularly as a mathematical science, then truth or goals must lie in the maximization of certain numbers. And so you kind of... I think that one of the changes in between the first and final draft of the bishop's letter was that one of the criticisms of the first draft was that the bishops did not sufficiently acknowledge that some of their specific goals may be at cross purposes with each other, and that or some of their specific policy recommendations. For example, they make a policy recommendation of raising the minimum wage because people should have a wage that will be befitting of human dignity. On the other hand, they wanted policies that would speak to the situation of high unemployment rates among black teenagers. And several economists said, well, if you raise the minimum wage, then probably that's going to heighten the unemployment among black teenagers. And so they're a little bit more cautious in making statements in the final draft. I mean, they acknowledge. But Jack?
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the issues for me is that there may be some scientific things related to it, and you can look at the market and you can plug your data in. But I think that if you look at the U.S. economy as part of a global economy and look at the poor in that light and not just the poor within our own borders, one of the things that you see, if this is my opinion, is that the reason you have so much hunger and poverty and deprivation out there is because those people have nothing to do with the market. I mean, they're victimized by the market. You can maybe put it in that way, but precisely the market responds to purchasing power, but the way that we structure the economy excludes a whole lot of people from having any purchasing power. So they simply don't fit into the equation, except to the degree that, well, maybe internally we should have some food stamps, or we should have. So you deal with them as a fallout, but you don't deal with them in any participatory
way. Yeah. Once one agrees that there might be some values, or it might be helpful to set some kind of social goals, then the next question is, well, who's going to establish these goals? Now, you were talking about the market, see, a capitalist economist, one who is committed to that particular kind of ideology, is going to say that the market simply should decide. And
now, that's the economist point of view, that the market is value-free.
Yeah, right.
That is a direct quote.
Right. Yeah, it's value-free, and that what we're doing when we allow the free market to operate is that we're all voting with our dollars. Now, this is Milton Friedman's model. If I decide I want I have to admit that I have this lust for a Mercedes, which I know is totally contrary to what I ought to want and all, but still I can't entirely purge myself of it. But if I decided to buy a Mercedes, say, instead of this, then I'm voting with my dollars that they should create more of these. Whatever. The problem with that is, as you say, then, you know, the guy who has $100,000 is going to have more votes, essentially, in the marketplace than the one who has $5,000. And so it's not a, it's not the same exactly as an election where you have one man, one vote. And so what the bishops want to do, as I understand it, is to try to devise strategies by which everybody can be involved in some kind of democratic process in establishing these kind of social priorities. And in order to do that, there are certain kind of minimal requirements that have to be met.
Has any representative or senator toyed with the notion of economic bill of rights?
Not that I'm aware of in any kind of overt way. I think a lot of them kind of maybe presuppose that, but there's not a...
Paul Simon would probably become the closest to legislation that either has or plans to introduce that would basically make the government a job supplier of last resort, and so it would be consistent with some of what's in there.
Isn't that somewhat a question, like, if we that make up the American economy and community all had a perfect value system as individuals, there wouldn't be a question right now why the capitalist system doesn't work to supply it for those that are in need. So I think a lot of people are afraid to say, well, We're not capable of doing it on an individual
basis.
Can we assign that to other people?
Yeah.
Value determination
scores
for their
representatives. Well, see, a part of the, and maybe we're bashing the capitalist system a little too much here. I wish we had an economist here who could step in.
We could bash him.
I think things like efficiency and growth are important. And I think what the bishops are trying to say is that most of the time we judge an economic system only in terms of things like gross national product, economic growth, the a raise, increase in the standard of living. And so the bishops, they do not want to say that these are not important, but that these should not be the sole criteria or even the most important criteria, that we need to ask other questions. Now, there's some real practical difficulty when you do this. Who counts as the poor and the marginalized? One problem with the bishop's letter may be that they did not interview the poor and the marginalized themselves. In other words, that they are not really practicing what they're preaching. That if indeed these people are to be a part of the discussion, then the bishops ought to have brought them in the preparation of the letter. So, I think there's a tendency here to want to see these people too much kind of as victims.